Hello, welcome to Long Shot Leaders. I'm Michael Stein. Today's guest is Jim Jordan. Jim is a world-famous fashion photographer and talent manager. He's photographed the likes of Leonardo DiCaprio, Charlize Theron, Mila Kunis, Drew Barrymore, Jessica Alba, Kris Jenner, and many more. His story entails being kidnapped at 15, Stockholm Syndrome, eventually dropping out of high school at the age 15, began working as a talent scout for modeling agencies. Then moving to Italy, working with Grazia magazine, working with celebrities as Cindy Crawford, Elizabeth Taylor, Sophia Loren, Farrah Fawcett, Herb Ritts, and many others. His story is fascinating. He's a super interesting guy. Here is Jim Jordan. All right, we're here with Jim Jordan. He's a modeling agency, got a White Cross Modeling Agency. He's got an amazing story. I'm so thrilled to talk to you about your story today. And I'd like to start at the beginning of your childhood. And like, first I started hearing your story, I'm like, is this like a John Casablanca story? But then it's like the opposite of him. The only thing is that you guys like went to Europe. You're from the Valley, he's from New York. But I definitely want to start at the beginning of when you were a kid and what your major wants were as a kid, and then how you got into the amazing Tour de France that we're going to get into.
Okay, cool.
So how would you describe your childhood?
How would I describe it?
Yeah.
Or you want me to describe it? I'll describe it for you.
Yeah.
My name is Jordan. I was born in Southern California. I grew up in Calabasas when I was a kid. My mom and dad were happily married. I have a brother and two sisters. And my dad was in the oil business and a restaurant business. He was an entrepreneur. And I was this little crazy kid that ran around full of creative gifting and art and into everything. And my brother was like a baseball star and my mom was a school teacher. And I grew up in very different than anybody my parents had ever met or my family. And with a total artistic gifting and so many different things. I was bonsaiing and trimming trees everywhere I went. If I ran into any dogs, I would shave their heads and trim their hair. And like, I was just creating everything always everywhere. You know, I was bullied. I was this little skinny kid. I was bullied. I didn't really have any friends. I didn't know how to relate to a lot of people. And so I went through this really lonely journey as a kid, kind of trying to entertain myself and figuring it out because I wasn't accepted really anywhere I went, or my parents were always trying to change me and medicate me and take me to psychiatrists and doctors and figure me out and try to make me the kind of son they always dreamed maybe they'd have, or what all the other young boys were like in those days. And
so then what did they try to medicate? Like, what kind of like medication would they try to do back then?
I was on like Ritalin and all these different kind of suppressants and medication. I was talking all the time. I was dancing. I was singing. I couldn't stop asking people questions. I was in school just failing D's, F's in every grade I did. And I was like, I couldn't focus on anything. And so they were taking me, trying to figure it out. Like, what are we going to give this kid to stop talking and asking people questions? And
what was your major want right around that time?
Oh, man, I don't know what I just wanted to be free and loved and fit in and be like everybody else. But I was really the farthest thing from that. And I was just typical. We were all kind of bullied in school and just felt like we didn't fit in and didn't know who our friends were. And I always liked my older sister and brother's friends, and I became friends with them. And so when I was young, to jump into a long story, I was a young kid and I was in school. My brother knew this guy who was a violent, like street fighter killer. And he ran a bunch of people over with his car and he put people in the hospital and killed people. It was a big gang fight in the Valley at the YMCA. And one of his friends was being beaten up by a gang and he got in his car and ran over the whole crowd of people. And
what year was this?
It was in the 70s in the Valley, in the middle of the Valley. And so he, back in those days, he was underage, he was under 18. So they gave him a ultimatum that he was going to go to juvenile hall or that he was going to go into the United States Marine Corps in the military. And so he chose to go in the military. And I knew this kid when I was really little, like 4 or 5, 6. My brother was friends with this guy. And the older he got, the more violent he became. And his father was in prison, in Terminal Island Prison, for counterfeiting. And he was a street fighter. He fought every single day, and he was robbing houses and gas stations and restaurants. And he was just like this terrorist. Everybody in the valley knew who he was and was afraid of him. And so he would always like see me around in the cul-de-sac where I lived. And when he'd come and pick up my brother and things, he'd always like pat me on the back like the little guy, you know? So he'd always be like, when I was little, he knew I was picked on. I didn't fit in and bullied. And I was just like scared of the world. And he'd always like look at me and goes, if anybody ever fucks with you, I'll kill them. So I'd always look at him like, wow, you're like a fucking crazy icon. The world's afraid of you. And like he would just stop and give me attention.
Right.
And so when I was in school, a few years later, he went into the Marines and I heard what he did. And it was like gnarly. Everybody was afraid of him. And he was, the older he got, the more violent he became. And so when I was in school, the classroom door opened. A year and a half later, he came out of Marine Corps, out of boot camp, and he went to Okinawa, Japan. And while he was over there, they taught him how to use guns and bombs and ammunition. And he became even more crazy and trained as a military Marine. And so when he came out on leave of the Marines, he would come to my high school. And I just got into the ninth grade. And he would sit around and try to pick up on all the girls out in front of the school and smoke cigarettes and hit on all the girls. I was in class one day in my biology class, and he opened the door and he walked in dressed up like really slick, and no one would ever know this guy was like a crazy man. And he said, there's been an accident in the parking lot. Is there a Jim Jordan here?
The military guy asked, why was he asking for you?
Well, I didn't know, but I was scared. And before he came in the room, he was staring at me through the little glass window in the door. And I looked at the glass window and he was staring at me for like 30 minutes before that. So I was like, what's he fucking doing? This guy's staring at me. That's Gary. And so he opened the door and came in and just walked right in front of the whole class and asked, told there was this accident in the parking lot and he needed to speak to me. So the teacher at that time weren't like, who are you? Give me your ID. They were like, hey, Jim, somebody's here to see you. So I went out into the hallway and I was like, hey, Gary, what's up? And he put his arm around me. He's like, come with me. So I was like, what do you mean? Like, where are we going? He's like, don't worry about it. Just smile and walk with me. So he walked out to the parking lot, opened his truck door, his passenger door, and he says, get in. I'm like, where are we going? And he's like, don't ask so many questions. Just get in.
And how old are you?
I was 15. And so I was like, dude, where are you going? I got to be home by 3 o'clock. My mom will call the cops. She'll come looking for me. And he was like, don't. And I'm like, kept saying, where are we going? So long story short, we went onto the freeway, 2.5 hour drive out into the desert. We were still going. Sun was getting dark. It got dark. It was getting, sun was setting. And I didn't come back for 6 months.
Where did he take you?
The first bout, we went to Death Valley and we were out in the desert. And we were sleeping outside and camping. And he was like, I'm taking you out to the desert so I can teach you how to become a man. And I was like, what does that mean? And he's like, I'm going to teach you if people are fucking with you. And I'm going to teach you how to defend yourself. And I'm going to teach you how not to be afraid anymore.
Did you ever find out why he kind of glommed on to you?
Yeah, because what I think now that I'm older and I look back, he was an outcast. And everybody was afraid of him. And he didn't fit in anywhere. And he knew that about me. And I was like the same, kind of on the complete opposite, polar opposite, where I didn't fit in either. And everybody bullied me and was afraid of me. And he knew I was this young little innocent kid that was just lost in the world. And I felt like so he took me out into the desert. And that first night we camped and he had all this like military stuff and guns and rifles and 22 gauge shotguns. And he was like, woke up, went to bed that night. And I was worried to death about my family and my parents.
Yeah.
And the cops came for me and he wouldn't let me call. And there were no cell phones and no beepers at that time. And I was just like along for this ride. And the next day we woke up at sunrise and he got all the guns out and started setting up target practice and bottles and cans and was teaching me how to shoot guns. And it's just crazy.
And at any point you're thinking you want to escape, but then you're in the middle of the desert where you're thinking there's no way I'm going to get out of here.
Yeah. On the way to the desert that night, we went into a gas station. It's a really long story. But we went into a gas station that night. He filled his truck up, both his gas tanks and his truck. The gas attendant walked up and he says, "Can I get your, you know, that's $80, or give me your credit card." And he just flipped the guy off, rolled up the window, flipped him off. And we just drove off, skidding out. And that night we went to McDonald's. It was like 11 at night to get food because we were starving. And he pulled up to the window. He ordered a ton of food. And he told the woman to give him the food, that he didn't have any money to give him the food. He knew that she would be off in 10 minutes. And if she didn't give him the call, he'd beat the fuck out of her. And I was like, "Are you serious?" So the lady like turned white as a ghost, gave him the bag of food, and we skidded off there. So the whole journey was robbing, stealing, threatening people. And I was just in this car like this little kid, like scared to death, like looking behind the back window, waiting for the red lights and the police to be following us. And this kid was just like on a death wish. He was just fearless, didn't care about anything.
So this is it day to day for 6 months. You're in the desert and you're doing this day to day. You're living like this. And what was the inciting incident that got you out of there?
We were in the desert for about 10 days and we were shooting guns, hunting every day. He's working out, like just robbing, going into town and doing crazy stuff. And then he was like, "I'm taking you to Hollywood now. I want to teach you about living on the streets." And I was like, "What does that mean?" And so he would drive down on a Friday night. We'd go down Sunset Boulevard and he was like, "This is where all the prostitutes are. This is where all the prostitutes hang out. And look here, see that corner and see this corner." And there were all these ladies of the evening on all these different corners. And so he pulled up to the prostitutes on one of the corners and they were like, came up to the car and they were like, "Hey, daddy." And he's like, "Hey, ladies, what are you doing? Where are you going?" She goes, "You want to have fun tonight?" And he's like, "Yep, I do. I want to have fun tonight. I want to show my son a good time." And so basically the first time he got these two black hookers in the car and got a hotel room, and we all went into the hotel room and they thought that they were going to have sex with Gary, this guy. And he basically said, "I want you to show him what it's like to have sex with two beautiful women." And so he's sitting in a chair, all dressed up, lit a cigarette, sat in the back in the corner. The light, the hotel room was on Sunset Boulevard. It was all dark and had a pink motel flashing light that flashed from the front of the hotel into the rooms. This flashing light with his smoke, his cigarettes. And basically, he was sitting there directing, orchestrating the whole thing on what to do to me.
And this is 10 days in.
And that was like his training to me of how to become a man.
And how long were you in Hollywood for doing this in the city?
So that was the night on Sunset Boulevard. And then the next training night was on Santa Monica Boulevard, where all the gay men hung out. And he taught me about gay prostitutes and the gay prostitution ring. And I knew nothing about Hollywood or prostitutes or any of that. And so he would tell me, "I want you to get in my car and I want to get out." And these gay men on Santa Monica are cruising in their car looking for hookups. And I want to get out and I want to hitchhike. And he got out and took his shirt off. And it was at 8, 9 at night. And he says, "I want to get in somebody's car and I want you to follow me." I'm like, "I don't know how to drive." He goes, "You know how to drive. You get in the front seat of my car. And if I get into somebody's car, you're going to follow the car, but don't get too close." And so he would take a shirt off, get out on Santa Monica Boulevard, hitchhike. Within 5 minutes, a car would pull over. And I was scared to death that he was like leaving me in this crazy car. And I had to follow him in his car. And he would scoot over in the seat and put his arm around the guy driving. And then he would pull through these back streets and follow him. My headlights were shining in the back of this guy's car way down. I could see Gary just start beating the shit out of the guy and stealing his wallet. He would just start pummeling the guy. And then he would steal his watch. He would steal his wallet. He'd steal his cassette players, anything in the car he could steal.
Now, did this guy know where your parents lived?
Yeah, Gary knew where my parents lived.
So at this point, you're thinking, I can leave. I have a car. But what were you thinking?
I thought I could leave.
Well, yeah, because you're in the car.
No way. I was scared to death of this guy.
Right, right.
There's no way I could even, that didn't even cross my mind.
Right.
I was so intimidated and scared of what this guy would do, come and find me. Plus, I was scared to death to even drive the car. I never drove a car before. That was the first time I ever drove.
Right. And the deeper you get, you think you're going to get implicated in something or you were to begin at this point.
Pummeling the guy in the car, like thinking, what did he do? I didn't know he was robbing the guy. I didn't know what his whole story was. And then he'd come running back to the car, back down the street to our car, and he'd be like, scoot over, and he'd throw in all this stuff. And we'd back up around the corner so we didn't have to pass the guy in his car that was probably bleeding. And
so this is going on for in Hollywood, in the city. So you're in the desert for 10 days. How long were you in the city for this part of it?
We were probably in the city probably a week, sleeping in the car every night. We go down to
what
LA.
Happened after the city? Where'd you guys go?
We were just all over. He had nowhere to go. We were just.
Did you ever figure out, let's cut to at the end of this, how did you get back to, obviously you went back to your parents. That's where you went?
Yeah, the first time I came knocking at the door for 6 months.
How did you get out of it?
He was like, it's time for you to go. I kept saying, I want to go home. I want to go home. I don't want to live like this. I want to go home. And he was like, I'll let you go when I'm ready to let you go. And then one day, like 6 months later, he said, it's time for you to go home. And I was like, dude, like, how am I going to go home now?
Yeah. So you go home. Where does he go?
And I didn't know where he was going, but his family, his mom and his little sister lived near, kind of near where I grew up. So he's like, it's time for you to go home. And we dropped me off like a mile from my house. And I was walking up to my house, knocked at the door, and my mom answered the door and was like, stunned, crying, like, I can't believe this. Where have you been? Thought I had died, didn't know. Thought I was like kidnapped or whatever. And cried and where I was and who I was with and interrogated me. And my dad came home immediately from work and they cornered me and they were just like, wanted to know where I was. And I was just like, I just was with friends and I don't, you know, it was a long story, but I got back in. And weeks into that later, Gary called again and I ended up, he says, I want to meet you, come down. That was probably a month later. And I went away with him again.
Even at that point, when you were back home, he says, I want to hang out again. And you couldn't say no.
He says, I want to talk to you. Can you meet me? And I was just like, what's going on? And he's like, I want you to come down to Valley Circle in the corner. I'm going to meet you at 5 o'clock. Come down. And so it was like a really long story. It's a long story. And he was doing a lot of really crazy shit. And he was kind of using me to help him do stuff. And we were going in and he was meeting girls and sleeping in their houses. And I was sleeping in the car and the parents would leave the next morning to go to work. And the girl would end up going to school and Gary would sneak back in the house with me and be like, we need to take everything, take all the china and all the watches and the clock radios and the TVs. And everything was very mapped out on what he would do. And he was robbing houses and robbing restaurants and robbing gas stations and doing everything like that.
How did you get out of this situation with this guy?
I came back home after the second spout of that. And my brother just turned 18. So I stole my brother's ID. And I went down to the passport office. And I got a passport. And I wore the same shirt that my brother had in his driver's license. And I went to the passport office in the same shirt with my brother's 18-year-old ID. And I was 2 weeks before I was 16. And then I got a passport and went and bought a one-way ticket to Milan, to Italy.
Why Milan?
Because when I was a kid, when I was in the seventh, eighth grade, I had this girlfriend. Her name was Tina. And she got discovered by John Casablanca, who owns Elite Models. And she was a Norwegian girl, and we were like this. She got discovered. John Casablanca swooped her off to Paris, and she became the supermodel. And I was devastated. She was like the love of my life, most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. She was taken out of my life. And I was like, she came home and told me she was in Beverly Hills with her mom shopping. And this man came up to her named John Casablanca, who discovered her. And so I was like, she was whisked out of my life. And I'm like, wait a minute. there are people like this man, John Casablanca, I have no idea who he is, that he could go and find beautiful people and then change their life and fly them off to Europe and make them supermodels. I want to do that. So I went to the post. So I went to the state. Like my story of who I am and what I did and how I started and how I connected with Gary and why I went away and why I went to Italy. I kind of jumped way before in this story I'm telling you about this kidnapping and this incident of who I was prior to that happening.
Right. So you go to Milan with a fake passport.
So I go to my buy
and you're 16?
Yeah, I was 2 weeks before I was 16. Wow. Bought a one-way ticket to Milan, and I go there, and I live in the park because I was on the streets with Gary living, swinging, you know, dealing, wheeling, and dealing, and I was going to the nightclub every night because I was staying in the park, and it was winter when I got
there. Wait, this guy, Gary, he didn't go with you?
No. I tried to get away from him, and that's why I moved to Italy.
Yeah. You're saying that you knew how to survive because of this guy, Gary, in a weird way. You knew how to survive.
And there was no way I was getting away from him. There was no way for me to go. And so I'm like, I got to go to Europe because the modeling agency. So I would go around when I before Gary, I would hitchhike and skateboard to every high school around where I live. Right. Hollywood, Chatsworth, Simi Valley, Calabasas, El Camino. I'd go to all the high schools and had a little card that said my name with my mom's phone number. And I'm like, I'm a model scout. I think you could be a model. Have you ever thought of a model? They're like, wait, how old are you? I'm like, I'm 15. I'd say, can you have your mom and dad call me? So my next door neighbor, Greg Glassman, is the CEO of CrossFit, the creator now.
Yeah.
And he lived next door to me. And we used to hang out and smoke weed and grow weed in the yard. He was my best homie. He's 5 years older than me. And he used to take all the pictures of these girls I was finding, and I would do their makeup and hair, and he would take the pictures. Yeah. And I'd be like, crop like this and do this, that. And so I got Greg, talked him into taking pictures because he's the only person I knew had a camera. And like 15, 20 models later that I was discovering, I was bringing in the elite modeling agency in Hollywood. And every girl I would bring in or guy, they were giving them contracts.
Wow.
So they were like, you have an amazing eye for talent. How are you doing this? Who's taking these pictures? Who's doing the makeup and the hair and this stuff? I'm like, oh, my next door neighbor takes the pictures, but I'm doing the hair and the makeup. And I'm hitchhiking to all these schools, finding these girls. They're like, you have a crazy eye. They're like, you should go to Milan and Paris with some of these models that you're finding. And the photographers, and you should do hair and makeup. Because I had the photographers and the magazines in Europe love Americans. And you do really good there. We know you're really young, but you should be a makeup and hair guy.
So and I was in like, Milan. Let's get to Milan now. You're in Milan. What happens there? What does it really hit traction for you over there?
Because the model agencies in LA were like, go to Milan, they'll love you over there.
Yeah, but you're sleeping in parks at this point when you first get there, right? So when you really hit traction while you're out there?
Was a dream what the agency said that you could be working for magazines and photographers doing makeup and hair.
So you're hanging out in Milan, you're sleeping in parks, you don't know where you're getting your money. How'd you survive?
So I was like in the parks, I had $1,500 to my name, and that included my airfare ticket and the rest. I went there with like $600 and I was going out every night clubbing. And so I was going into the nightclubs and I was trying to meet people to go home with at night so I didn't have to sleep in the park. And I ruined different shit I don't want to talk about on the podcast, but I was surviving shit and I was doing stuff and I was working the streets and like hustling. Doing my thing, getting people to feed me and take care of me and sleep in their house and their beds and doing whatever I could. And those were really amazing times. And I was fearless because I was trained to do shit like that by the craziest person I'd ever met. And I was doing that. So I was at a coffee shop one morning and I saw these models in there, these girls, these Russian girls. I was like, hey, are you models? They're like, yeah. I'm like, hey, where's your agency? Where are the agencies here? And they're like, oh, right around the corner. Like five of the biggest agencies and model agencies are on the street right next to where we are. And I'm like, can you give me the names and blah, 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 blah. So I went in and walked into the model agency and I'm like, hey, I had a ponytail, a really long bleached hair, a skateboard. I'm like, hey, I'm Jim. I'm from California. I've been scouting all these models and doing hair and makeup. Could I talk to somebody here? I don't know anyone. So this man, Luigi, came out. It was the owner of this agency called Fashion. And he's like, hello, amore, are you? And I'm like, hey, I discovered these models in California and I wanted to meet you. And I do makeup and hair and I take pictures. And here's some of the pictures I've been doing. And he loved me. And he was just like, oh, my God, you come in the morning at 10 o'clock in the morning and I'll make meetings for you to go meet magazines.
Wow.
So I went to meetings. And he made me meetings to go meet like the Grazia and all different magazines. And I was at an interview meeting a magazine after like the eighth meeting. And the man said to me, hey, we have studios upstairs and one of our makeup artists didn't show up today. And we're behind and we have models on set. Can you go up there and work right now? And then it was for a magazine called Grazia. And I ended up doing the cover that day and a 10-page fashion story doing in the hair, and the other magazines were all in the same big, it's like Condé Nast, and started meeting people, and boom, my makeup and hair career took off. To make a long story short, I was in Milan till I was 19. So I was there 2 weeks before 15 to 19, and I was working for Vogue and Harper's Bazaar and tons of magazines, and I was going back and forth to Paris and Milan, and I had a full-on job now. And I had money and I got my own apartment and I was on it and I was working pretty much every day. And when I was 19, I came back to LA.
What are you telling your parents at this point when you're 16 and 19 years old? What's happening? I mean, you got the fake passport. They got to be wondering what's going on. What was that relationship like?
My parents said I was leaving and I was going to Europe. And they were like, my parents, I used to do hair and makeup. My mom used to slap me around when I was a kid. She's like, stop doing that. You're not doing that. Like, what are you doing? And I didn't want to have a badge. I never thought I was a hair and makeup person ever in my life. I'm a fashion photographer. I shoot covers of every magazine. I don't really have a badge saying I'm a photographer. So I'd always live my life like, I'm just a street survivor. I'm just doing shit. I'm faking shit till I make it. But I went there and I was faking it, but I really got, like, people were like, whoa, you're really good at this. And so my parents didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't tell them I was going to do makeup and hair in Milan and go be in the fashion business. I was just like, I'm out of here. And I got in a big fight and tried to justify it with my family. So I just left and I'm like, later. And I moved away and I didn't come back. So I came back when I was 19 and I had covers of Vogue and Elle and all these magazine covers. And I met a hair and makeup agent in LA and the record started representing me. Week later, I was doing Farrah Fawcett and I had a huge career. I was working with Elizabeth Taylor and Sophie Loren and Farrah and Molly Ringwald, Jeff Bridges, Kurt Russell, Nick Cage. And I was traveling between New York and LA, working with Herb Ritz and Helmut Newton and the biggest photographers in the world. And I did that for 15 years. And when I'd work with like Cindy Crawford on the beat for Bloomingdale's, I'd bring my little camera and I would take pictures behind the scenes or like in our lunch break. I started collecting all these photos and I hid them in a box. And I didn't tell anyone I was taking pictures at that time because all the photographers I worked for would never work with me again if they knew I was taking pictures. Because back then, everybody was really competitive in the photo world. And so I had all these amazing opportunities to take pictures of these people that were my clients. So I hit all these photos and boom, I launched as a photographer.
So you're doing that. And then when did you start your modeling agency?
I have a management company. It's not really a model agency. It's a management company.
Okay.
I started in like 2005. I started discovering Ben models. I ended up having like a life transformational God experience. And I ended up in the hospital almost on my deathbed.
What happened there? What's that?
My life is so much.
Okay. Rewind there. What happened with the, what happened?
I got really sick. I didn't know what was happening. I was in Las Vegas doing a guest speaking at the for Nikon, sponsored me. Yeah. I got really sick in the morning, was puking my brains out. So sick. I'd never been that sick before. I had to cancel the guest appearance. I flew back to LA, was laying in my bed, like thinking I had food poisoning that evening. I was just like, if I could just get through 10, 20 hours, I'll be feel better. I started throwing up blood. I ended up the next morning in the hospital. in the ER, they came in, they're like, your kidneys are failing. I didn't drink. I was a pot smoker. I wasn't really a drinker at all. And they're like, your kidneys are failing and you're a diabetic. And I'm like, never been a diabetic and my kidney never had problems ever. They're like, well, this doesn't look good. We need to call in a kidney specialist. Call in a kidney specialist, like your kidneys are the size of a dime and they're not working. So I ended up like, when you're dying like that and you're that sick, you just want to die, literally. And so my mom was like covering itself. Like I was just like laying there. I couldn't breathe. I had oxygen on, IVs in both my arms. And I was just like wanted to die. And the kidney specialist comes in. They do ultrasound on me. He goes, you're not, this does not look good. Your kidneys are non-working and you aren't going to make it to the end of the day today. And they're like, is this your family here? My mom, my dad, my sisters, my brother were all there. They were all crying. They knew this didn't look good. Doctors telling them I'm not going to live to the end of the day. And it was 12 o'clock. So I was just laying there, you know, and I'd never been religious. I was a Buddhist and I was into every religion all around the world, friends with the Dalai Lama, been to Tibet, been to India, looking for God in every religion and every culture my whole life. My sister was a Christian and I was always like, I don't like Christian people. They're finger pointing, judgmental. And the guy they think is their God is going to send me to hell because I take naked pictures and I shoot and I'm just like this hard guy. And I always thought I couldn't be that guy for Jesus to love me. So I'd always ran from Christianity and finger pointing people. And I was on my deathbed and doctor left and he asked me if I had a will and if I was an organ donor and that I need to start making arrangements with my family to do a will before the end of that day. So everybody left. My sister asked everybody to leave the room. And I was like, what's she going to do? Start preaching to me? I was just laying there like, oh no, why is she asking everyone to leave? After the doctor left, she asked my parents and sister's brother. So all of a sudden she said to me, I want to talk to you and I know you're really sick and I want you to tell me if you understand what's happening. And I said, yeah, the doctor told me my kidneys are failing and I'm a diabetic and he doesn't think I'm going to live to the end of the day today. And she goes, that's exactly what he's saying. And I know you're really sick and I want to make sure you're thinking clearly and know you know what's happening here. And she was like, if you believe that God will heal you, God will heal you. And I'm like, oh God, don't start preaching to me about Jesus. So story short, I turned my head away from her because I didn't want to look at her because I thought they were going to start preaching, her and her husband. He was a pastor, my sister's husband. So I closed my eyes and I was like, okay, God, here I am. Like I'm laying here on my deathbed. The doctor just came in, told me I needed to do my will, asked me if I was an organ donor. And here I am on my deathbed. And I've been into Buddhism and I was into every religion there is. I was at the Kabbalah. I was going around the world in every retreat looking for God in every culture there'd ever been for this moment. And I started seeing pictures, started like flashing in my mind, like me on my hands and knees in people's living rooms, chanting and meditating, being in India, being sitting with the Dalai Lama in a room at the Chateau Marmont, praying with them and all these different religions of me. And I heard a voice say, you have nothing else to believe. And I was like, and I knew the voice that I heard say that to me when all my pictures were flashing to me searching for God my whole life. And I looked at her and I said, okay. And she goes, okay, what? And I go, okay, I'll believe that. She goes, you'll believe what? And I'm like, I'll believe that. I didn't want to say it. Like, I'll believe Jesus will heal me. So I just looked at her and I said, I'll believe that. She goes, you'll believe what? And I'm like, I'll believe it. Because I didn't want to say it. I wanted her to say it. She goes, you believe what? I'm like, I believe that Jesus will heal me. At that moment, I didn't have anything else to believe. Like none of these other gods are coming to save me. What? Maybe I heard that voice and I knew it pertained to that. So she goes, okay, we want to pray for you. And when we pray for you, you need to have faith. And I was like, what's faith? She goes, it's something that you hope for that you can't see. And she goes, you need to have as much faith as that your name is Jim.
You need to have much faith as your name is Jim. And this is the turning point that healed you? And how long were you healed after that?
They start praying and they start speaking in some weird Latin language, both of them. And I was like, what the hell? They're speaking like Latin?
Not like tongues or Latin language?
I didn't know what it was. I thought it was Latin.
Okay.
And I just had this crazy experience, and they started praying for me, and I didn't know what faith was, and I just started, never knew about Jesus or teachings or who he was or what they think he is or what he did or what he does, anything.
But so obviously you survived, and you're here today to tell us that you got better.
I'm here, and my body started convulsing on the bed, and I'm shaking, and they were praying for me, and I thought I was convulsing and dying, and I stopped it, and I opened my eyes like, oh my God, I'm dying. And I felt like this is something to do with me getting healed. So they kept praying. They weren't even phased. They prayed again, more and more and more. I started shaking again. Boom. And as soon as it's just something happened in there, and I was healed, immaculately healed. Went home perfectly healed the next morning.
The next day.
The next day, a doctor released me, said he'd never seen a miracle happen like that ever in his life.
Where is this, in LA?
Yeah, he said he was a kidney specialist for 30 years. And he says at the end of the day, he came back to do ultrasound. He said, your kidneys are working perfectly, functioning perfectly normal.
And what year was this?
This is in my late 20s, early 30s. And so he let me out of the hospital the next day, and my life changed. And I was like, you know what? It's not about how rich I can be now and how famous and how many covers and celebrities and best friend movie stars I can be best friends with. It's about me going back to my roots and finding young kids that are lost in Hollywood and their dreams, and all these agents and managers and people that have side-railed all these people. And before their careers even started, they were over. And I just saw so many beautiful people and that have been in this business that have been devastated. And I saw the trick, and I knew what to do, and I knew how to help people. So I started, you know, I just got closer to God, and I just started praying. I just started asking God, like, what am I here for? Like, what's my purpose? What's the big plan? Like, what? I'm not just to have a big houses and everything I'd ever want the world think is cool. What am I here to do?
But then you ended up being more successful after that, which is basically, it seems like, with all the businesses that you opened up after that.
I opened a company called White Cross Management, and I went back to my roots on scouting talent. And I discovered Taylor Hill, the biggest model in the world when she was 14. She makes $30 million a year now. I discovered Gigi Hadid, and I discovered Jeremy Meeks, the hot felon. Took him out of jail, and I talked to him every day, every Monday for a year and a half while he was in prison. And I built him up, and I encouraged him, and I spoke life into him, and I prayed for him.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that, you know, he was a popular, he gained popularity. I'm sure there were other modeling agencies calling him up, or other management companies. You saw that? You saw this guy in the news or whatever? Tell me, how'd that story go down?
I saw Jeremy's mugshot, and I saw it on the news. And a few weeks later, I never thought anything. I'm like, oh, that guy's cool. And I heard all this thing going, the buzz around him. So a friend called me up, and he said, hey, you know that prisoner dude, Jeremy Meeks, the blue-eyed felon dude? And I'm like, yeah, you should be managing him out of everybody. And I'm like, no, I don't want to start competing and calling them up, and all these agents are already on it, and I'm not going there. So he goes, no, seriously, you out of everybody should be managing him. So he goes, I know somebody that knows someone that knows his family. You should send him an email. So I sent an email. Hey, my name's Jim Jordan. I'm a celebrity fashion photographer, and I'm a talent manager, and I discovered blank, 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 all these supermodels that people know. And I said, I would love to talk to Jeremy about helping Jeremy. So I got an email back the next day, and she says, fuck off. Stop trying to my client. So I call up my buddy, and I go, I just got this really hateful email from this woman telling me to fuck off and not to poach her client. So he goes, you should call that lady. Call her. Is her phone number there? So I call her up, and he goes, tell her who you are. So I call her up, and I've said, I forget her. I think her name's Gina. So I said, hi, Gina. My name is Jim Jordan. I'm calling. I sent you an email, and you sent me an email this morning that not to poach your client. And I just want to apologize. I had no intention of poaching your client. I didn't even know he had an agent or manager. I have no intention of doing that. I just wanted to help him. And she's like, what's your name? And I go, Jim Jordan. I could hear her typing. She goes, wait a minute, are you a photographer? And I said, yeah. And she says, wow, you're a really good photographer. And she goes, He goes, tell me about yourself. And I'm like, I'm a fashion photographer and I own a management company, and who I had discovered and I wanted to help. And she goes, wait a minute, where do you live? I go, I live in the Oaks in Calabasas. She's like, wow, it's such a small world. Maybe we should meet. Long story short, I meet the woman. She comes to my house the next day. She was this ex-porn star. And she starts telling me how Jeremy, when he gets out of jail, he's going to come live with her and her daughter. And I could tell she was like in love with them. And I was like, this is weird, all this stuff. So I call her up. She goes, I want to team up with you and manage Jeremy with you. Because you're like the fashion.
Oh, boy.
You know more fashion world than I do. So let's merge and team up. So it was like a handshake. And I call her up and I said, if I'm going to work with this guy, Jeremy, have you met him? She said, no. I go, I want to fly up to San Francisco and meet him if I want to work with him. So I fly up there to meet him. I meet his wife, Jeremy's wife. She looks at me and says, hey, thank you for coming up, but I don't know you from Adam, but I want to tell you about this woman, Gina. She goes, first of all, we're not signed with her. We don't even know her. And she wants to fuck my husband. And I was like, you don't know her? And she goes, no. And I was like, whoa. So this lady is just like, this is crazy. So I end up sitting with this woman, his wife, all day long. I go to the prison to meet Jeremy. They won't let me in because they think I'm from the press. Because
yeah.
They see my magazines I shoot. And they're like, you're not coming in here. So I spend the whole day with his wife. We hung out in the car all day. And I told her my whole life story. Right. And she's like, I really like you. And she goes, I'm going to tell Jeremy about you. So she tells me about Jeremy, and she says, Jeremy has a phone call every Monday for 15 minutes. The lights are going out. And Jeremy's has a phone call every 15 minutes, every Monday. And I'd like him to talk to you, but I want to talk to him about you and who you are. So Jeremy calls me. I had to put money into his account at the jail, even my credit card. And then he calls me that Monday and he said, hey, I'm Jeremy. They're like, you have a call from the federal prison, you know, you accept. And I said, yep. Jeremy's on. He goes, hey, I want to thank you so much for really flying up here and caring about me and speaking to my wife. My wife really, really liked you and thinks you're the real deal. And so me and Jeremy started having phone calls every Monday. And it lasted for like a year and a half. And I started sending him books and things to write and to journal. And I started reminding Jeremy of who he was and what he's here and the call on his life. And that it wasn't from his past and the things of his circumstance of where he grew up and all the people he knew.
So that's really hands-on for you. That's just not regular management. That's just you shooting from the heart.
Yeah. He just had a really amazing connection. And then Jeremy got out of jail and I went there to meet him the day at the jail. And his wife was there and his kids. And they wouldn't let me on the premises of the jail because they knew me and they didn't want me there on the grounds. And they went down this big dirt road down to the prison and they were going to. And then 45 minutes later, here comes their car. And he was in the front seat. I was standing in a cornfield and a big field in the middle of nowhere. And I was with my team. And Jeremy came rolling up in the passenger seat of his wife's car with his three kids in the back. And he had his orange jumpsuit on. And he rolled down the window. I was like crying. Like, dude, I can't believe you're here. And I was like, got out of the car. Give me a big hug. And he stripped his jumpsuit off and he put his sweats on and put his wife beater on. And he just lit me up and just like, dude, I can't believe you're here. Like, you really came for me.
It seems like you got really emotionally attached. Would you say you get emotionally attached to the people that you manage?
I love people and I love helping people. And I, you know, yeah, Jeremy, he's a special person and he's amazing. And we've spent some amazing times together traveling the world. And I'm just happy for him. And I'm so happy of how he transformed his life and that he let the past go and he moved on. And I watched him, how it could have gone really bad for him after jail and how it could have been what happened.
Well, I could see how much it's hit you viscerally, you know, and I can tell by all the time you invested in that there's more to it than just management. So let's wrap this up. What's the next for you? Where are you going from here?
Well, what's next for me? I have a number one best-selling book I just produced. It's called The Fifth Vital with Logan Paul's best friend on his number one podcast in the world. I put him together with a writer, my writer. I have a new book coming out about my life story that's being written right now. And I have a bunch of different things happening in the network. And I have a clothing line, I have a cosmetic company and a skincare line that's being launched now. And I have an amazing talent that I'm managing and fostering. And I'm just very hands-on with my management style. I'm very much a talent manager, but I'm more in developing people, helping people wind the minds and helping them really see, have vision and how to execute their vision by walking and manifesting that. I'm very into helping and mentoring and teaching people. I consult a lot of people. I love doing that. And I love just like sharing my story, like where my hard knocks in my life of how I became out on the streets and lived in the parks and was homeless and became fearless and being in situations that were really scary for me, that kind of strengthened me to give me the boldness to go after my dreams. And I still am doing that.
Yeah. You know, everything that you had to deal with led you up to the zenith of your point, you know, where you're at right now. And it's an amazing story. And when you finish that book on the Bod biography, we got to have it back on the show and we got to have to talk about that, because encapsulating that in a book, it's really hard to do it in a 45-minute podcast. But encapsulating a book, I'm sure there's a lot more. And I really would love for you to come back and kind of get into that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I know it's hard to tell my story in 45 minutes, but.
Well, you did a pretty good job. And I can tell it's not the first time you talked about it before. So it's an amazing story. And I really appreciate you sharing it. And I'm looking forward to seeing more from you, because I can tell that this is not over. You know, your story is just, you know, masticizing even bigger. And I'm intrigued. And when do you think you're going to be done with that book?
I'm thinking hopefully by June.
Right.
So I'll keep in touch. I'm working with a writer named Riley J. Ford. She wrote a New York Times bestselling book, and she just wrote The Fifth Vital for Mike. I put her together, and that's a New York Times Amazon number bestseller right now. And we're doing a movie. I'm selling a movie to Lionsgate for that book, and we last book to Netflix. And
that's awesome. Jim Jordan, that is one of a kind story, and I appreciate so much for you sharing it. It's amazing. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. I hope so. Take care.
That was a heck of a story. Jim Jordan. The world of modeling has interesting characters. Jim's story is different than John Casablanca's, but it's equal in how interesting it is. Dynamic, charismatic characters, nonetheless. Thanks for joining us on today's episode, and I look forward to hanging out with you on the next. All right. If you want to find out more about our show, go to longshotleaders.com. If you want to be a part of something special and get your daily dose of inspiration, perspiration, exasperation, knowledge, and creativity, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we do, share our show with your family and your friends, and put some positivity out there in the world. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again on the next episode, I bid you adieu. Where did I get French from?